Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has three submissions on its oral docket, the first of which is a consolidated case. In the order in which these causes will be presented, they are as follows. City of LaPorte versus William Barfield from Harris County. Combined oral argument with City of LaPorte versus Alan Ray Prince from Harris County. The Board of Law Examiners versus Edwards H. Stevens III from Travis County. And Cisco Food Services Incorporated and others versus Benjamin Trapnell and others from Nueces County. In the first two oral submissions, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present argument. In the final matter, the court has allotted 30 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The petitioner may reserve a certain portion of this argument time to present rebuttal by so advising the marshal of our court. We will take a recess in between the presentation of each of these arguments and will complete the oral submission docket before our noon break. These arguments are being recorded for the convenience of the court. If anyone desires to listen to a tape of the arguments, you may make application with our clerk. Court is now ready to hear argument from petitioner in City of LaPorte versus Barfield and Prince.
May it please the court. Mr. James P. Wallace will present argument for the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Please report. My name is Jim Wallace. I practice law here in Austin. Counsel favorite with me is Mr. Charles Dippel from Houston, trial counsel in these matters. The court granted writ, as you're aware, on two points of error. Those points have been very thoroughly briefed by both parties. I think the applicable law is set out. So with the permission of the court, I will attempt to respond to any questions the court might have. And after that, reserve 10 minutes of rebuttal to the respondent's part.
Well, from reading your briefs, is the effect of the law that you would have us declare it to deny municipal employees any right if they are treated in bad faith by their employer as a result of
I haven't gone to the extent of considering all possibilities, Judge. It's just the fact of this case is the only thing I dwelt on.
You're not aware of any remedy they will have then if the cities begin firing employees just on a routine basis because they dare to file a workers' compensation claim? You're not aware of any remedy those employees have?
Not for a municipal act, if they're engaged in a municipal act under 8307 as it was adopted by 8309.
I didn't pull out all of these statutes, but would that also then treat municipal employees different than any other public employees?
Public employees, you mean?
At other, in other employees of other governmental subdivisions in the state.
I don't believe so, sir.
This isn't something just unique to municipal employees. This would be, there would be nothing then that a state employee or a county employee or a school district employee would have as a right if they were discharged by a employer acting spitefully.
If they were performing proprietary function, they would have the cause of action, yes.
But not otherwise.
I don't think so.
From a public policy standpoint, is there some reason why these municipal employees should have less rights than other Texas employees?
It's just the way the law has evolved. Municipal privilege, immunity, is a matter that basically can be waived only by legislative act, and it's my understanding and my belief from reading the statutes and their application that the state legislature has not affirmatively waived municipal immunity in this situation.
Are there any other questions? I believe...
Can you respond to the respondent's argument that when the legislature adopted Article 8309H permitting cities to self-insure against workers' compensation claims, that they thereby waived sovereign immunity to the extent of the cause of action for wrongful discharge under 8307C?
Yes, under 8307C, that, of course, was enacted back in 1971 when the workman's comp was not, cities were not mandated to have workman's comp. 8307C speaks of persons, period. 8309A referred, when it adopted 8307C, to the fact that if you had a subscriber, an employer, then those terms took on certain meaning. But those terms were never used in 8307C. So the legislature did not do away with the requirements then existing as to governmental immunity when it merely adopted 8307C and 8309H.
What I'm referring to specifically is tab E of the response to the application under section 3A5, 3A says the following law, this is in 8309H, subdivision 5 says, section 3A says the following laws are amended or as amended or as they may hereafter be amended are adopted. And section 5 refers to chapter 115, acts of the 62nd legislature, regular session 1971. Why doesn't that specifically incorporate Article 8307C and waive immunity to that extent?
I don't believe that act adopted 8307C, because 8307C was enacted in 1971.
I'm just referring to a typewritten tab E in the response.
You say 8309H was not adopted, I believe, until 73, was it, originally?
The reference here is to 1981.
81. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you said 71.
The 71 was when the 8307C was adopted.
8309H was amended and then been amended several times in.
But the reference here suggests that the legislature incorporated the cause of action under 8307C when they adopted 8309H.
Well, they referred, they were adopting 8307C, and then I believe that's the same amendment 8309H has stated, that when the word employer is used in the above law, I believe that they adopted portions of Articles 1 through 4 of the Compact and all of Articles 5 through 10, plus 8307C. And they said that when in the above law, where the word employer is used, it shall mean a political subdivision. Well, the word employer doesn't appear in 8307C at all. So, if the application of those other sections of the compact, it would be synonymous. But 8307C just doesn't cover employer. It doesn't mention it at all.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court. Mr. Dale W. Felton will present an argument to the respondent.
May it please the court, I'm Dale Felton. I practice law in Houston. At the council table with me is Mr. Timothy Hootman, who represented Mr. Barfield in the trial court level and at the court of appeals level in this case. I would like to respond first to the question and just take up where we left off. If I understood the question correctly, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, I understood the question to be under tab E of the response to the application for writ of error being the short version of Article 8309H as it was adopted or enacted in 1981. And that passage of that legislation in 1981 the legislature adopted Article 8307C and made 8307C applicable to political subdivisions as therein defined, being counties, cities, etc., as the statute lays out as printed there in Section 1.1 of the Act.
And it's your contention that it thereby waives sovereign immunity to the extent that 8307C would apply?
That's correct. By adopting this legislation, they're saying that it makes these acts applicable to political subdivisions, 8307C being one of them, and thereby waives governmental immunity. 8307C says a person who violates this statute shall be liable. So it creates a liability. Now, with regard to whether or not a city is a person, the statute also says that when the word employer or its equivalent, they also mention subscriber or association, but that's referring to the insurance company with regard to association. So the word employer would be the key word, or its equivalent appears in the legislation, that would also mean a political subdivision, which would also mean a city. They also adopted in this legislation Article 8309, which is the general definition section of the workers' compensation laws. And in the definition section of Article 8309, the word employer is defined, and it starts off in the definition, employer means a person. The very first word they have is a person. So if employer means person, person is an equivalent term to the word employer, and since employer means a political subdivision, which also means a city, then the word person also means employer, which also means a city. So that's how the legislature did that, by incorporating these various statutes that apply to waive governmental immunity. I would like to say that this appeal is very, very limited, both in the number of cases because of the time frame involved, and in the scope of the cases because a city is involved. We are dealing, I believe, in these cases with only a handful of cases that are currently in the legal pipeline. I say this because the most important point to be considered by this court, in my opinion, is the fact that the 1981 version of this law applies to this case. In 1989, when the legislature enacted the new Workers' Compensation Act, which was over 300 pages long, a broad sweeping change in the legislation of the workers' compensation law in this state, they included a savings clause in Section 17.18 at the end of the omnibus bill, Senate Bill 1, that said this law, this new Workers' Compensation Act, will apply only to cases occurring after January 1 of 1991. Now, what they said there was that it will apply to injuries occurring after that date. So, therefore, when they amended the Workers' Compensation
Act... Injuries are causes filed.
It says injuries occurring after that date, is what the language of the statute says. Now, when they amended the Workers' Compensation Act, then they knew that this was broad sweeping changes in the law of workers' compensation, and that they intended it to apply only in the future to new cases. Injuries that have occurred in, say, December of 1990, on-the-job injuries, are even though they have not been filed as litigation, even to this day, can still be filed as litigation after they've gone through the Industrial Action Board hearing process and what have you, under the old workers' comp law, because the savings clause says that the new law applies only to injuries occurring after January 1, 1991.
The San Antonio Court of Appeals has held the 1989 law unconstitutional. Is that part of this legislation you're referring to?
It is part of the legislation.
And that's, I suppose, on its way here. What impact is that going to have on this case?
It won't have any impact at all, because I'm saying and telling this court that these cases, the Prince and Barfield cases, and perhaps another, I don't know, handful at best, are in existence that under the 8307C cases against municipalities, maybe another four or five in the whole state, I don't really have any idea how many, that would be impacted by this appeal. Because this is under a time window between 1981 and 1991. And that any case that where the injury occurred prior to 1991 and then the worker was fired would already have to be in suit because the statute would have run in January of 1993. So it would already have to be in the legal pipeline at this point in time. Now, the reason I say that the 1981 version applies to this case is, first of all, because the new act had a savings clause saying that it was to apply prospectively to injuries occurring after that date. A wrongful discharge case cannot arise unless there's first an injury. A person has to be injured on the job before it would ever give rise to a termination that arose out of that injury. So it would be the legislature determining that the injury would be the determinative event that would determine when the cause of action would apply. So our position is that clearly this cause of action is under the 1981 version of 8309H.
Now, when, excuse me, if this had occurred then after January 1, 1991, what would be the position of Mr. Barfield and Mr. Prince?
If it had occurred after January 1, 1991, then the new workers' comp, or the new 8309H, the amendment to 8309H would apply.
All right.
But because it didn't, it doesn't.
Would they have a cause of action against the city for wrongful termination?
Quite frankly, I have to look at the court and say there are a lot of different questions under the new law versus the old law. And I have wrestled with those questions just like the court did in Barfield. I have Mr. Hoogland's permission to tell the court that the reason that the savings clause wasn't pointed out in Barfield was because he omitted it. But they have since, in the Vaughn case, which I submitted to the court in a short letter brief, that was written after Barfield, gone back and looked again and have found the savings clause, and in Vaughn determined that because the Vaughn case arose prior to 1991, that the new workers' comp law did not apply, and that it was under that time window also. So our position is that the amendment that went into effect in January 1991 creates a whole different set of questions that need not be answered at all in this appeal. That this is limited just to that time window of cases between January 1, 1981 and January 1, 1991.
Except that if it's clear under the 89 Act that there is no such cause of action against the city, that would be some indication of the legislature's prior intent, wouldn't it?
I don't believe that there's really any indication that there is no cause of action. They readopted 8309H in the new legislation. They did not take 8307C out. They did not say that it would not apply. They did readopt 8307C, but there is language that creates a new set of questions that might apply to punitive damages, various things of that nature.
And the language is that you can't have any other, notwithstanding the Workers' Compensation Act, you can't have a cause of action or damages against a political subdivision other than allowed by the Tort Claims Act. Is that
That language is the language that has to be dealt with, that has to be wrestled with, and that's what the court tried to do in Barfield. Quite frankly, I can see to look you in the eye and say, honestly, there's a number of different ways that one could interpret what the legislature meant when they wrote that. I would have to say that.
And
but that is not present in the 1981 law prior to this.
And if you can interpret different ways, how do you deal with the court's pronouncement in Duhart versus State, where the court states that in order for the legislature to waive immunity of any claim, and do so by clear and unambiguous language?
Duhart is very distinguishable from this case, Your Honor, and the reason that it is because in Duhart we were considering whether or not a statute's adoption that says a certain type of cause of action is not prohibited if one exists, versus in this case where the legislature adopted a statute and said that we're making this statute applicable to political subdivisions, and that statute says you will be liable if you violate it. What we had in Duhart was a situation where it says, if a cause of action exists, it's not this act doesn't prohibit it. But it did not adopt a statute which created a liability. In that case, it was wrongful death involved, and the defendant in that case was the state of Texas, actually the state highway department. Now, the cause of action that they brought was under the Wrongful Death Act. The Wrongful Death Act did not was not adopted in the statute that adopted making certain workers' compensation laws applicable to the state. It did not adopt the Wrongful Death Act, so therefore the legislature did not create a liability against the state. All it said was we adopt 8306 section 5, which says if you otherwise have a cause of action, this law doesn't prohibit it. Big distinction. And here we have where they adopted in 8309H, 8307C, which says a violator shall be liable. So there's a huge distinction in the two instances. So Duhart just doesn't apply to this case.
Ordinarily, the suits within the waiver of the Texas Tort Claims Act does not waive governmental immunity for punitive damages. But you contend, I think, don't you, that 8307C, if it applies to the city of La Porte, also waives sovereign immunity for punitive damages.
Actually, yes, I do. This is this cause of action, 8307C cause of action, is outside the Tort Claims Act. So the Tort Claims Act itself and any limitations of the Tort Claims Act do not apply to this case.
That's not because you consider it a proprietary function, is it?
The proprietary government of the function distinction has no bearing in a case outside the Texas Tort Claims Act.
Why would the legislature create exposure to punitive damages in such a roundabout way?
Well, the legislature can make causes of action applicable to various units of government to whatever extent that they, of course, desire to do so. And when they make cities, make a law like 8307C applicable to a city, then it's outside the Texas Tort Claims Act where there is no limitation other than the common law limitation with regard to punitive damages.
Can you think of any other analogous statutes that do that?
Yes. In fact, Kerrville HRA, which is one example, in that case, it's Kerrville HRA H Incorporated versus the city of Kerrville, where the court found that the city of Kerrville was liable for fraud in a real estate transaction. Fraud being an intentional act, 8307C being an intentional act, and that is very important in this case. As you have to remember, punitive damages being applicable to a city in this case are being made applicable in an intentional tort type of an action. And so it seems rational that the legislature has, if we're saying that the legislature has made them exposed to liability by adopting 8307C, we are exposing them to liability in an intentional tort action. The other one I'm saying is under 2701 of the Business and Commerce Code, being liability for fraud in a real estate transaction. The legislature has made cities liable for fraud in real estate, and it's outside the Tort Claims Act, so the law pronounced by this court would apply as to whether or not you can recover punitive damages from the municipality. We have to remember, Justice Cornyn, that governmental immunity is a creature of the common law. Governmental immunity is created by the common law, and this court has said what governmental immunity that the state and the city would be entitled to. And as Justice Heck pointed out, this year in Guillory versus Port of Houston Authority in 1993, and as well as this court pointed out in the Heigl case in 1892, so good law for 101 years, and up-to-date law, is that a city is entitled to different immunities than the state. Or conversely, the state and its subdivisions are entitled to different degrees of immunity because the political subdivisions created by the state, such as a navigation district in the Port of Houston Authority, or a school district, a county, have the role of carrying out the state government at the local level, where a city is created for the pleasure of its inhabitants and actually are a form of self-government, and look only to the legislature for what they cannot do, not for what they can do. While the county has to look to the legislature for what they must do. So they say, the law says that there is a difference between governmental immunity as it applies to a city and applies to other units of government. That's the second reason why I say this appeal is limited.
Leave it to the court, Gilbert. I was just spoken.
You wrote the opinion, and that's what I was referring to. But that's why I say the first reason this appeal is limited is because of the time frame involved. It's a time window case between 1981 and 1991. The second area is that we're dealing with a city versus other unit of government. It is clear, as you said, that the law says that in order for punitive damages to be recovered against the state, that they must be expressly authorized by statute. But this court laid the issue to rest 6 years ago in Gladewater versus Pike, that with regard to municipalities, punitive damages are recoverable if they're not otherwise barred by immunity, such as if the legislature has said that punitive damages are not recoverable in this situation. If you can show an intentional act, well, an 8307C cause of action is an intentional act, and it's committed with malice, which we did in the Prince case, and that if the conduct complained of can be imputed directly to the governing body of the city, then you can recover punitive damages against the municipality.
If both damages and punitive damages can be recovered against the city under the 1981 Act, is there any indication that the legislature changed its intent in the 89 Act, other than the language of the statute itself?
As far as the intent of the legislature, I would have to just refer to the opinion in Barfield. I reread Barfield again last night. The court wrestled with exactly the very questions that you're posing, and there is numerous ways that you can look at and interpret the language that they have there.
Conversely, if the present act does not admit of such recovery, is there any indication that the legislature intended that as a change from the prior law?
Well, obviously they intended to make a change because they made one. And that's all I know really to say. I have my views with regard to each one of these different changes. As the court in Barfield pointed out, the section 101.003 indicates that the Texas Tort Claims Act, the causes of action authorized there are in addition to other statutory remedies, and that court believed that that's what the court what the legislature was referring to was other statutory remedies that it had authorized, and that it thereby incorporated those other statutory remedies as being part of the Tort Claims Act. And that was the interpretation of the court in Barfield. That's why I say there are many questions that, honestly, I believe would have to be answered when construing that statute as to its application and its breadth. But my point is, and the point I'm trying to make to the court, is that that is not part of this appeal. These questions that were raised in Barfield don't have to be answered by this court in these cases present before the court because of the savings clause that applies. And as the law with regard to construction of statutes says, that when you look at that body of law, particularly Ex parte Able, a case out of this court back in the mid-80s, is that it is presumed that when a statute is amended that the legislature amends a statute, that it will apply prospectively only, and if there is any doubt about it, it will be applied prospectively only. So even if there is any doubt about it, in this case, the doubt will have to be resolved that amendment in 1989 would apply prospectively only, and so this case, or these two cases, would apply under the 1981 law.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
a few comments regarding the points raised by Mr. Felton. As was pointed out, and has been the rule of law ever since I've been practicing law, is that there is government immunity unless it is waived by the legislature. And the rule has been enunciated by this court, not only in Duhart, but in 1987 in Hoskin versus Spring, HISD, and in 1989 in Mount Pleasant ISD versus Lindbergh, that governmental immunity exists until it is expressly and unambiguously waived by the legislature. And the question before us really boiled down to the question, did the legislature clearly and unambiguously waive governmental immunity when it adopted 8309H? The legislature was well aware of the way you waive governmental immunity, and the Tort Claims Act is a very good example. They say immunity is waived in these instances. The problem to get from where Mr. Prince and Mr. Barfield are trying to go get to the decision they want is they've got to get around the 1989 version of 8309H. And they say there's a savings clause there because the court said in an action for an injury occurring under this act, under the Comp Act, you take the date of the injury. An injury under the Comp Act is an injury to the physical body. 8307C is not an injury. 8307C raises a cause of action for damages. And that one sentence in 8309H that you're urged to find to be a savings clause just doesn't cover this type of cause of action under 8307C. One word about the city of Gladewater and it allowing punitive damages. The city of Gladewater was a proprietary functions case. In the city of Gladewater, the city manager had absolute control over the city cemetery. It was suggested that he consider the recommendations of the city council, but he had absolute control. And this court says that reasonable damages include punitive damages in that situation. But that was a proprietary case. You didn't have the question of immunity raised there. Exemplary damages against the city was approved in that case, but again, it doesn't touch the workman's comp case, topside or bottom. As to whether or not 8309, the 89 version as opposed to 81 version controlled, you have another question here, whether or not this was a remedial statute, and what it does is provide the means whereby someone claiming the cause of action under the statute could go into the court of law and enforce their right. Now, from all my understanding, that's a remedial statute. And the law is quite clear, as set out in the briefs, that when you have a remedial statute that is amended, effective as of that day of amendment, no matter what the progress of an underlying lawsuit is, the new remedial statute controls. So any way you consider it, the 1989 controls. And it very clearly says that the only damages available under an act under this case, under this statute is that set out in the Tort Claims Act. And again, this type of injury is not included because the Tort Claims Act includes an injury to the physical body or injury to personal property caused by the operation of a motor vehicle or tangible personal property. And we just don't have that in this case one way or the other. Again, as I said, the legislature knew very well how to waive governmental immunity if they wanted to. They knew how to do it concisely, expressly, clearly, and unambiguously, because they'd done it several times before. The Whistleblower Act is a good example. The legislature waived immunity there. They said, we're waiving immunity, period. And it's clear and unambiguous. So I just have not been able to understand how you can get from the confusion that exists and the adoption of these various versions of 8309H, adopting 8307C, never mentioning the waiver of governmental immunity, and how you get from that situation to a clear, unambiguous waiver of immunity. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the first set of causes, and the court will now take a brief recess.
Please rise.